Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live in the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network. Joined in the studio, as always, with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How are you doing, Sas?
Fine, how are you?
All right, Nastasha's trying to contact someone to set up one of our 8 billion events. How many events do we have this?
Too many.
How many do we have today? Only one today.
Yeah, but Bobby Flay's going to be at the bar at 6 filming.
I know, but we won't be there.
But you should be there. And
how am I
going
to be there? Our
event
starts at 6.
Mr. Tam, what's right after this.
But no one knows what we're talking about.
I know, but I'm just letting you know.
Nastasha's like, and my brother Phil, he was... No one knows who we're talking about. Mr. Tam is the contractor at the new Booker and Dax space. I mean, nice to speak on the air. You know, can't wait 15 minutes to tell me off the air. Man, it's okay.
50.
15. We go on break every 15 minutes. No brains. Also joined with Jack. Intrepid Jack.
Yeah.
How you doing, brother?
I'm good.
Good. Calling all your questions live to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Missed you guys last week because I was in Germany and we couldn't get the scheduling going with the, you know, because I was actually, I think, teaching something or doing some sort of judging during the actual radio program. But had a good time in Germany. Didn't get to have any really good, solid, real German food because I didn't have time to go out to any kind of good restaurants, which is not... I went out to good restaurants. I didn't go out to like a hardcore German restaurant. I love German food. Stas, you like the German food?
Love German food.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, you know why?
Why?
Because it's hearty.
Yes.
You love some hearty food. It was interesting. The contest I was judging was for a Havana Club, which, you know, is a rum. There is a Havana Club rum here in the United States, but it's not the actual Havana Club. The actual Havana Club is made in Havana, and therefore we can't get it in the United States, which is kind of an irritant. But, you know, they got to straighten that crap out soon. I mean, how long can we hold a grudge against those guys?
Don't know.
I mean, it's been like what? Like, see, 40, 50, like 50 years almost? 50?
Yeah,
50 freaking years we've been holding a grudge against these guys? I mean, I don't really care about the cigars one way or the other, but it would be nice to get the rum in. You know, you can take planes there apparently now quite much more easily than you did before. You don't need to like pretend. It used to be to take a plane from Cuba, there was like 2 planes a day or something like that, and you had to pretend that you were a journalist or some sort of crazy nonsense, but apparently now it's okay. Spent a good deal of time when I was in Germany with Ryan, and I'm not going to pronounce his last name right. He's another C last name from London, so I can pronounce Conigliaro for some reason. I can do that, but Ryan's last name from the Worship Street Whistling Shop, used to work with Tony actually, Tony C, at 69. Ready? Chetayawardana.
Whoa.
It's hardcore. Even he says he can't pronounce his name properly. And check this out. He's doing some interesting stuff. Like he's you might know some of the bar stuff he's doing because he has a balloon that he has a lemon, I think, essence sprayed on. He then like lights a string. The balloon flies up in the air and explodes over your head like as he serves you the drink. Interesting stuff.
Cool.
He's aging drinks with radioactivity. He's like handing them to people who are, I guess, doing radiation experiments either for food or for medicine and, you know, nuking the hell out of stuff to see whether he can accelerate it. Interesting stuff. I look forward next time in London to go to the bar. Anyways, so what was I talking about? I was just talking about Ryan. Is that
Berlin.
On? Oh, anyways, check this out. Dude's family. I mean, he's, you know, he's British, right? Dude's family from Sri Lanka hates spice.
Wow.
Says he is like a complete pariah at family gatherings. Like black pepper is too spicy for him. It's messed up, huh?
Yes.
Messed up. Anyway, we were talking Rotovap because he's got Rotovaps coming out of his ears, as most people. Tech people in London do. Are we going to get that new Rotovap? We might get a new Rotovap.
That's just who I was emailing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. All right. Anyway, let's start.
We got a Rotovap in Japan.
Oh, we're going to Rotovap stuff in Japan? Nastasha and I are going to Japan in how long? Like 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Anyways, we're going to Rotovap stuff there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, it's going to be a freaking nightmare. All right, we'll see how it works. Okay, first in from Bjorn in Sweden in Umeå, I guess is how you pronounce the name, right? Umeå, because the A with the little dot over the top is aw. Oh, which means river, I think, in Swedish. A question on wild game. Hi, David. My name is Bjorn, and I am a chef in the north of Sweden. I have a problem when I brine wild game, especially reindeer and lagopus, which is what they call grouse. Lagopus. Good one. I normally do a solution between 4 and 10% with normal salt, sodium chloride. But when I cook the meat in low temp, I get a gray line around the meat, maybe 2 or 3 millimeters, depending on the time and the percent of the solution. It seems that the line gets more present on darker meat, especially when you cook low temperature. With normal frying and cooking, it's harder to see. If I use nitrates to get a pink line, I get a pink line, and I don't want to do that. I've done some testing using ascorbic acid and citric acid with no result. What can I do? Best regards, Bjorn. Okay, now listen. This is actually a big problem in general. One of the reasons that we don't recommend pre-salting on a lot of low-temperature meats, or brining for that matter, is it changes the texture of the meat as it's cooked over a long period of time. But color also can be quite affected. In fact, the color of meat is due in large part to the state of myoglobin, which is one of the proteins in the meat as it's cooking. So there's three, there's many actually, but there's, some of the main kinds of myoglobin that we deal with are deoxymyoglobin, which is what something looks like inside of a vacuum bag. That's myoglobin with kind of no oxygen bound to it. There's oxymyoglobin, which is the bright pink-red color you get from what we associate with kind of fresh meat. And then there's metmyoglobin, which is basically a reduced form of its, it's a different iron oxide that gives it kind of the brown color. Now, salting, right, affects several of these things. First of all, when you cook meat low temperature, when you cook meat in a vacuum bag, first of all, you're cooking with you're reducing the oxygen component so much that you get a lot more deoxymyoglobin than you would under normal circumstances, and that takes a long time to denature. It actually denatures slower under heat than either oxymyoglobin or metmyoglobin does. So that's why in low temperature meats, also the slower you heat it, the less any kind of myoglobin denatures. So that's why in low temperature cooking, and especially in high vacuum bag cooking, you can get kind of very kind of pink results even at higher temperatures, because you're not going to, and also when you cut the meat, it's going to cherry up and get this bloom, because you're not going to get denature as much of the myoglobin as you would otherwise. Now, salting does two things. It increases the rate of metmyoglobin, which is brown kind of production, right? And it also increases the rate at which myoglobin is denatured and takes on a cooked look. So, and it, like by a lot, by more than double. And that effect is more pronounced at lower temperature cooking than it is at higher temperature cooking. So the study to look at here is the effect of muscle type, salt, and pH on cooked meat hemoprotein formation in lamb and beef, which came out in 1999. It's right there. You can read it. It's the adding salt rapidly increases the rate at which myoglobin is going to get denatured. That effect is going to be magnified at low temperatures, and so having the salt in there is going to give you more of a cooked color and give you a color line in that meat that there's really kind of no way around. But one of the good news is that you might not need to brine your meat as much or at all, really, if you're doing low-temperature cooking, because you don't need to protect the meat against overcooking. Now, if you're doing it for flavor, that's one thing, but not gonna affect it. Another problem is let's say you were going to marinate for flavor, use a brine like an acid. The lower the pH, also, the myoglobin is going to denature. So you can't win by putting an acid in. You can't win necessarily by putting an antioxidant in like you did. It's just one of the things. If there's salt there and you're low temperature cooking, you're probably going to see a line to the extent that salt has soaked into the meat. So that's all there is to it. They did in that study, which you should look at, they also tested to see whether adding fat changed the rate, maybe to help you out. It did not. They also added polyphosphates, soy proteins, casein, and none of these things had any effect on the rate of myoglobin denaturation, which is, I believe, what's causing the problem. So that's that. What do you think?
Good.
Also, salt can increase the rate of lipid oxidation. Will increase the rate of lipid oxidation in meats. Anywho, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave, Nastasha, and the rest. How you guys doing?
Doing all right. What's up?
Hey, before I ask my question, I want to say thanks for the nixtamalization thing on your blog. I made corned beef tacos for St. Patrick's Day with rye tortillas. It was awesome.
Oh, I love the rye tortillas with corned beef. That's sweet. That's a great idea. They were good?
They were awesome. Grinding it, of course, is the problem. I tried, a mortar and pestle, and it didn't work. What I ended up doing was just putting all the rye berries in a blender with enough water to make a puree out of it, and then I added just enough of that maseca to thicken it back up again, but still had tons of rye flavor. and the texture was so great. Even fried, you know, for crunchy tacos.
Right.
Had just a great chew to it.
I think that's a great idea, adding the Maseca back, because really, the only reason that you need the hardcore grinding, you know, implements like the Corona, which doesn't even work that well, or like, you know, the really, you know, the big professional jobs, is because to grind it at home in a processor or blender, you really need to add more water than you can to make a tortilla. But adding the Maseca back is a genius way to get around that. And I think, you know, well within the bounds of like. Maseca, like as much as I griped about it in the article, it's not a horrible product. It's just, and it sounds like it sounds like a great plan. I'm glad that worked. I might do that from now on. Make my life easy. I hate using that Corona grinder.
Yeah. Hey, how'd your rum talk go?
Oh, rum talk went well. I didn't talk about it. When I was in Germany, I was supposed to be talking about and was talking about the effect of yeast on distillation, because everyone who does home brewing kind of knows that yeast really affect, like what yeast you use affects the flavor of the beer that comes out. But a lot of people don't think about it when it applies to distilled beverages. So what I did was I took the same crappy whole food molasses. It wasn't crappy, whatever. I don't mean to insult it, although it was crappy. And then took three identical batches, pasteurized them all, and pitched two different yeasts into it, and then did it at two different temperatures to show the effects that the yeast has. And the yeast is, I mean, a huge majority of the flavors that are produced in a lot of distilled beverages, the esters, the fusel oils, all the congeners that we think about, with the exception of just pure molasses aroma or cane aroma, come from the yeast. And so I think it was really kind of an eye-opener to some people to see, you know, kind of how important particular yeast strain is, and which is why people are kind of proud of it. But have you ever visited a distillery? When you visit distilleries, they never talk about their yeast. They go right past, they let you taste the fermentation, they show it to you, but they don't make a big deal out of it the way they make a big deal about their stills, or the way they make a big deal about the raw materials that go in. And it's really kind of a vital thing. So the talk went well, in other words.
Yeah, I used to be a head distiller at a rum distillery, and we did a lot of experimenting with, we were doing like fermenting with German Hefeweizen yeast and, British fruity British ale yeast at high temperatures to try to get different character, and they were just wildly different. Not only just the flavors, but the distillates themselves were just, you know, one would be just full of acetone, and the next one would have virtually none. So it's really interesting.
Huh? Are you allowed to say who you used to distill with?
It's a rum distillery in New Orleans called Celebration Distillation. We make New Orleans rum, and we even tried. We found this dry yeast that's isolated off of Guatemalan sugarcane, and it was, you know, to make the rum agricole, and it was just so phenolic and plasticky that no matter how tight of a cut we did it, it was just really too much. But it's fun experimenting with all that.
Yeah, I mean, the tough part, I guess, is like, you know, I was talking to the Havana Club guys, and you know, they. You know, they make a big deal about getting their own yeast off the cane that comes out of the field then, but then they need to be consistent, and that's the big pain in the butt. That's why you can't go totally wild on this stuff, and why no one, you know, none of the big players can go totally wild, because if they go totally wild, there's no way they're going to get a consistent product out of it. So then they're put in the position of kind of propagating a particular yeast strain over the course of years, which then becomes, you know, difficult, I guess. I mean, they don't talk about that aspect of it. They make a big deal about their yeast coming from, you know, their area being kind of endogenous to their area, but they don't, or indigenous to their area, but they don't, you know, they don't talk much about how it's, you know, kind of kept as a culture over time, or kind of how many strains of yeast there are in it, you know?
Yeah. So my question is, I'm looking to start a small craft soda business. And I've got a lot of good recipes already, like a ginger habanero soda and a cucumber Thai basil soda. And my question is, you know, with a lot of the cucumber and watermelon, I mean, it tastes awesome and the color's beautiful, but if it sits overnight, all the particulate matter settles out.
Right.
So what do I need to add? Is it like guar gum or something like that? Is there anything? Because I want this to be as, you know, natural as possible. Is there anything that's not going to scare people off to see it on the label?
So you want to keep the stuff suspended?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could add. The problem is that anything that's going to keep it suspended is going to also, I mean, obviously you're going for kind of low levels of carbonation. Otherwise, you're going to get massive foam out anyway with the particulate matter that's in there. But there's, you know, you probably don't want to move to something like a PGA pectin. I mean, certain pectins would do the job suspending. I mean, that's what I spend most of my time obliterating pectin to try and desuspend everything that's in it. You know what I mean? So depending on the particle size that you have, I mean, if it's stuff that'll pass through a coffee filter, for instance, it can easily be suspended with pectin. Now, the next thing down is you could I wouldn't want to go in a soda because I don't like what happens to the body of it, but, are you suspending big things or small things, like big pieces of herbs or like just –
I'll juice a cucumber and strain it out through a fine strainer and, mix maybe a Thai basil tea in with it. And but just all it's the particles are big enough, I guess, or small enough where they'll go through a fine mesh strainer.
Right.
And it'll be in solution for a day, but if I'm serving this in draft, it's all going to settle to the bottom of the keg.
You're not bottling it. You're just putting it in a keg.
I'm going to just do Cornelius kegs and, sell it as a kind of an alternative to craft beer for people who are, trying to, sober up at the end of the night, or just people who like, interesting sodas, but,
Right. I mean, one thing to do is to treat it. I mean, obviously, you're a distiller and a brewer. To treat it like a beer and rack it. But do you like the flavor of it better before with the particles in it? Do you like the look and flavor of the particles, or you want to try and think of a way to get rid of the flavor, the particles? I mean, you could just go a wine finding route, rack it, and then get all of that stuff out of there and be left with a clear soda. In which case, you could up the volumes of CO2 that you pump into it as well, and get more of a bite out of it from a CO2 standpoint. The flip route is to try and stabilize it. And I would guess if you want a really good label declaration with something like that, this is just a straight up guess because I haven't thought about it, is some form of pectin. similar to, think about all the crud that's sitting in grapefruit juice, and that stuff is totally stable. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's basically because of pectin. And other suspended kind of plant, matter in there, like hemicellulose and pectin. So I would bet that you could get some sort of stabilization that way. I haven't researched particularly what product, but who you would talk to on that is the guys at CP Kelco. CP Kelco, they make all of the, they're like the pectin people. And they're fairly helpful. So they would probably have some sort of product that you could use. If you want to go like a straight hydro route, I mean, the good thing about pectin, fantastic label declaration. You could just say what it comes from, like citrus peel or apple pomace or whatever in the hell. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then the other people who I would talk to on stability, and CP Kelco also handles some of the other stability stuff. I mean, FMC Biopolymer, they handle a lot of the beer stuff, but I don't think you want to go, like I said, PGA, like propylene glycol alginate, all that stuff, kind of head stabilizers for beer and things like that.
Right, no, I don't want that.
I don't think you want to do that. And I don't think you want to add so much body because it's going to be a real huge problem on foam out to do something like a gum arabic xanthan mix, which is what we use as our main emulsifier. Now, gum arabic is a good emulsifier and might hold stuff in. I don't know, though. It's not really a thickener. You know what I mean? But that was used to stabilize soda emulsions. But I don't know that it's going to stabilize stuff from sinking. It's more of an emulsifier in case you had fats and oils in it. You know what I'm saying? Then TIC gums, they're pretty good, and they spend a lot of time thinking about label declarations, and they might have a good way to go. Scott Riefler's their guy out on the West Coast, and I don't remember who is here on the East Coast. But they have a lot of proprietary blends, which are might be a monetary issue for you if you're a huge producer. But if you're not a huge producer, then the cost is going to be negligible based on the fact that you're juicing fresh cucumbers. You know what I mean? So. So I would hit up CP Kelco, see whether they have a pectin product for you. I would hit up TIC Gums and see whether they have a straight-up stabilization. And then as a last resort, I would go to FMC Biopolymer.
All right, I'll look into those. I remember before in a previous show you had talked about coriander and green Thai chili soda or something. Of any other interesting flavors you could throw my way?
Oh, I don't know. Well, really expensive ones, but that one's good. In fact, we're using that one tonight. We're making a drink. We're doing a Lucky Rice event tonight, and we're making an old fashioned with that coriander syrup. You know, in general, for us at Booker and Dax, we like to stock one or two syrups around that are dual purpose. So we can use the coriander for an old fashioned, and then I can also make a soda out of it. You know what I mean? That's why we always have. You know, I always have a clarified lime juice sitting around, so we can always make a lime soda if we needed to. You know, obviously, but you know, the stuff that Nastasha and I have done in the past before we had a bar has been extraordinarily expensive stuff, like straight strawberry juice and raspberry juice, you know, turn into a soda. Delicious. Remember that one, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
Strawbunkle soda? Yeah, that stuff is amazing. Fantastically expensive, though. I don't know what you'd have to charge someone to serve that as a soda. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, I'd have to charge like mixed drink prices or more even. And then people would be like, I'm paying $14 for a freaking soda. I'm like, well, there's 2 pints of blueberries in it. What do you want out of me? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm looking to do kind of like similar prices to a pint of beer, you know, $3.50, $4 for a pint of, you know, craft soda. So
right. So you want to stick with stronger flavors that you don't have to put as much in, and then have the majority of what goes in be water.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Do you have time for one question?
Quick one, then we got to go to a break.
I was wondering about aperitifs and digestives. Do you think that it really works? Is alcohol good for? Does it impede digestion, and or does it stimulate digestion, or is basically alcohol bad for digestion? And if you have any favorite aperitifs and digestives?
Huh. I've never thought of that, whether it actually doesn't, because I discount all health claims in general for everything at all times. So I've never actually thought about it, but I'm sure someone has done the study of kind of rate of digestion and alcohol consumption both before and after. What do you like to have before a meal? Do you like it? You don't really do that kind of stuff,
no,
right?
No.
I mean, I like Campari.
Yeah, that's true.
I like a Campari beforehand. And afterwards, I don't go for like the upset stomach, pound some Fernet afterwards, or like, you know, the late night Fernet shot that all the bartenders go for. But I don't know. I haven't thought about it. I'm going to think about that one though and come back. In fact, if you send a question to Nastasha for next week's radio show, I'll try to remember to do some actual research on alcohol and digestion. Alrighty.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Thank you. All right. Hey, Jack. You want to go to our first commercial break?
Yep.
Let's do it.
Oh, turn me on, Bill.
I'm the show, you're the show. When we get through, you're gonna holler for more.
Bump, 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 baby. Bump, bump, bump.
You get up, we get down. Bouncing on the bottom
of the bounce. Well, bounce on, baby. It's all right.
Bootsy! Oh, hell yeah, Jack. That was a good call.
Oh, thanks.
What album is that?
I'll check it out in a minute. I'm not sure what album it's from.
Bootsy's Rubber Band. Oh, hell yes.
Yeah.
I love Bootsy. You know, Bootsy's still playing. Still out there with the star-colored bass and the star-shaped glasses. Amazing dude.
Stretching out in Bootsy's Rubber Band.
That's the album,
yeah.
I'll tell you something. If you don't like Bootsy Collins, you just have some severe problems with you.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
Your butt's broken. Your funk motor is busted. You need to turn that son of a bitch on and go out and listen to some Bootsy. Anyway, today's show is brought to you by Chris. Who's it brought to you? Today's show is brought to you by Modernist Pantry. You're back. We love you. We missed you. Modernist Pantry. Supplying innovative ingredients for the modern cook. Do you love to experiment with new cooking techniques and ingredients but hate to overspend for pounds of supplies when only a few grams are needed per application? Modernist Pantry has a solution. They offer a wide range of modern ingredients and packages that make sense for the home cook and enthusiast, and most cost only around $5, saving you time, money, and storage space. Whether you're looking for hydrocolloids, pH buffers, or even meat glue, you'll find it at Modernist Pantry. And if you need something that they don't carry, just ask. Chris Anderson and his team will be happy to source it for you. With inexpensive shipping to any country in the world. There's got to be some country he won't ship to.
Maybe.
Hey, listen. Here's a challenge. All you suckers out there, go try to come from a country that he will not ship to. There's got to be something. Cuba.
Zimbabwe.
We'll talk about that later. Okay, if we have time, we'll talk about our possible Zimbabwe trip later. Anyway, whatever. Anyway, we'll talk about it. Anyway, with inexpensive shipping to any country in the world, Modernist Pantry is your one-stop shop for innovative cooking ingredients. Modernist Pantry carries VersaWhip 600K, a modified soy protein, which is a great replacement for egg whites and gelatin in whipped applications like meringue, mousse, and other hot or cold foams. Fans of cooking issues that place an order of $25 or more before next week's show will get a free package of VersaWhip to play with. Simply use the promo code CI81 when placing your order online at modernistpantry.com. Visit modernistpantry.com today for all of your modernist cooking needs. So there are several VersaWhips out there, and as they say, VersaWhip is either a soy protein or actually a milk protein, whey protein. There's two different ones, a soy one and a whey one, and they function slightly different. I guess Chris is selling the soy one. If you're using VersaWhip for the first time, the other good whipping agent that a lot of us use is Methocel F, like Frank 50 is a good whipping agent. It's different. Proteins are whipping agents because they're large, charged, and they're large and in charged. Anyway, and so they're good at aeration and whipping agents, and foam stabilizers. It's not really a whipping agent. They're foam stabilizer, and I guess it could be a whipping agent. But you might want to add some solids also to increase whipping when you're going. Another thing about VersaWhip, VersaWhip can be weird. In other words, like when you're whipping an egg white, it kind of lifts up kind of like slow and steady. VersaWhip, you can whip it for a while, nothing, bang, you have a foam. So if you buy it, just be aware that it might happen, and don't give up right away when you're whipping stuff, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Steven writes in from Moscow with, remember he was moving to Moscow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And with water for coffee. That sounds like a book.
Just water for chocolate?
Yeah. Jack. But water makes much more sense for coffee than for chocolate, right?
Yeah.
Anyway. Hello, all. Love listening to the show. Listening for a long time. Wanted to follow up on equipment issues I called in a few weeks back. I live in Moscow and the water is absolutely horrible. That's too bad. Too bad. I usually get bottled. Our water here is good. Anyway, I usually get bottled mineral water shipped in, but I want to go for an under-the-sink filter. The local bottled water is not too bad and has an okay taste, as everything's not filtered out of it. The big coffee head that I am, I need to have something to play with, water-wise, filter-wise. So see, that filters seem to clean out most of the crud. The filters that he finds that seem to clean out most of the crud tend to be reverse osmosis filters. But at least from what I hear, the water tastes really bad out of a reverse osmosis, a.k.a. an RO machine, because it filters out almost everything. But is an RO machine really the only way to go? Will a basic multi-filter system work for me? Any specific processes that you would recommend, brands, etc.? Okay. Keep up the good work and let us know when you're heading to Moscow. Stasi was almost going to go to Moscow like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
What the hell happened?
The storm.
No. It was Iceland. The volcano erupted, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then no one would fly over that thing.
Yeah.
And so she's like, meh, meh. It's typical, right? You were like, resign yourself to it.
Yeah.
You're like, that's it. Because, as those of you that know, Nastasha is the curious mix. Not really half Russian, like quarter Russian, quarter Ukrainian, but we call it Russian, no offense, Ukraine, and half Mexican. So she's trying to see whether she can go to Russia and also deny that half of her existence.
Yeah.
I'm just messing with her. Anyways, the problem with reverse osmosis is that it takes out almost everything in it, and coffee needs to have some mineralization in order for it to taste good. So there's a couple different things you could do. You could go RO and then use actually mineralize it afterwards. And I didn't have a chance to look up. There's some companies that will sell kind of kits where you can kind of remineralize the water. That said, I don't know what's in the water in Moscow that makes it taste bad. At my house, even in New York, we have a decent water supply. The particular pipe that mine comes through occasionally is chlorinated, and so I filter all of my water for coffee, and I use a multi-stage filter. You want to go a big filter first. When I say big, I mean, somewhat porous, and it's going to capture most of the stuff that will clog the later filter. And they have filters that, they'll have filters that'll take down almost everything, down to cysts and tiny little things, but they'll also remove almost almost all of the flavor out of it as long as the water is safe to go. The issue with those filters is that when you add multiple system filters in a house system, you are decreasing the pressure coming through it by a lot. And so you want to make sure that you get enough pressure through it. You want to make sure you change your filters. I use the GE home water stuff. I don't know whether it's sufficient for what's going on in Moscow. Or you could have an alternate problem is that the water is not just bad tasting, right, or, you know, it has problems, but is also too mineralized, in which case you need to demineralize it and then remineralize it somewhat. But I totally agree with you. Reverse osmosis system is not the way to go. I'll send us back some more parameters about what actually your problem with the water is over there, and I'll take a look and see whether or anyone else who has some experience with some real hard water places and coffee maybe can write us in and tell us what they use. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Tom Fisher writes in about gum syrup. Hello, Dave, Anastasia, Jack, and Carlos. Carlos is not with us anymore, brother. Yeah. Carlos doesn't like us anymore. Jack, what do you go to do?
He's around.
He's still around?
He is working at a hotel. I think he's delivering meals as a room service or something like that.
Specifically because he hated us at the radio show. I think
specifically because he hated Nastasia.
Wow. Hardcore. You should see the faces that Nastasia shoots off at the
exactly.
people here. It's
he
crazy.
One too many vegan faces, I think.
Yeah, you know, we have people here, like they're eating their pizza. Nastasia gives them a look out the window. They just push the pizza to the side. They can't eat anymore. They leave. It's crazy. Anyway, Tom Fisher writes in. Recently, I've been given a book of cocktail recipes, and glancing through it, one ingredient kept jumping out at me. It's an old book, I guess. Gum syrup. Confused, I looked up several classic recipes, drinks that normally have sugar or sugar syrup added, but in this book, all these drinks call for gum syrup. I have the ingredients on hand, so I don't necessarily mind making the syrup, but is there any need to do so? Does the gum arabic really make a difference? Also, in searching for a recipe for gum syrup, I found half a dozen different versions. What do you recommend? Thanks, and hoping you're having fun in Germany. Tom Fisher. Okay. For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, gum syrup is where you, instead of just making a regular simple syrup, which is just sugar and water, you add a boatload of gum arabic to it, right? Now, I would add as much as you kind of can, right, within the realm of pourability. The interesting thing about gum arabic is, other than the fact that it comes from tree sap, and the fact that, for a while there was problems with it because it was coming from an area in Sudan, and maybe you were supporting terrorism and or genocide by buying it. I think that's been fixed now. I'm not sure. Anyway, I shouldn't say stuff like that. Just like, you know, kind of like off the cuff as though like, because it sounds horrible. But I think they might have fixed those problems. Anyways, gum arabic is really cool because unlike most hydrocolloids, which are long chains, right? Gum arabic is very highly branched in a similar way to a millepectin is very highly branched. And so it's a very kind of large weight hydrocolloid polymer, but is also not too thick, even in kind of very heavy solutions. It also has a protein in it that acts as an emulsifier, which is why it was used for a long, long time, or still is used, although it's expensive, to stabilize soda syrups that have some oil in them, because it also has the really cool capacity that it holds its emulsifying capabilities even when it's diluted radically and quickly, which is why it's great for things like soda syrups. It also adds body, which is why it's in these drinks. So it's an emulsifier, which means it's going to, in a shaken drink, it's going to make the bubbles hold longer, and it's going to get a better texture on it. And that's basically why it's there. I'd say it's worth it. I've never experimented exclusively with straight gum syrup, but we use a mixture of gum arabic and xanthan called Ticoloid 210S for all of our emulsified fat drinks, like cold buttered rum, in all of our house-made orgeats that we have. We have like a walnut orgeat, we have a pistachio orgeat, we have a toasted almond orgeat that we do at Booker and Dax, and we use this Ticoloid 210. We also have, we never put it on the menu, but we do it for one-offs, we have basically what we call Tick Syrup, or Tick Simple. And it is a mixture of gum arabic and xanthan, and it's basically like a modern-day gum syrup. And when you shake it into a daiquiri, let's say, you get kind of it's a different mouthfeel. So half the people really love it. Half the people prefer regular simple syrup in it. And so it's hard to say it's not better or worse. I think it's creamy, and it kind of gets a better head, more foamy. I kind of like it. Do you like the Tick Simple, or do you like the regular better? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
You don't remember? Like, but it splits along lines. So I would definitely recommend making some and trying. And we should do some regular, good old-fashioned gum syrup. But if you're going to do it, freaking do it right. Add a boatload of gum arabic. Right? I mean, like, don't sissy around with it. It's expensive, though. Maybe one reason not to. Anyway, hope that helps. Okay. Should we take one more and then we take a commercial break? We don't have time for a commercial break. I'm going to rip this stuff through. I'm going to rip through this. Teddy DeVico wrote in about the foie gras ban in California. I'm curious to hear your opinions on the upcoming foie gras ban in California. The way I see it is that animal rights activists are just choosing a battle they can win so they gain momentum to tackle the real criminals like Purdue, Tyson, etc. I enjoy foie gras and personally think banning all foie gras in California is ludicrous. However, some foie gras producers do treat their ducks and geese horribly. But then again, the same goes for chicken, pork, beef, etc. The government should send out inspectors to approve of farms before they are allowed to sell their products. And also, they should check up on the farms on at least a yearly basis to make sure the animals are treated humanely. Teddy DeVico. I don't really know. Here's the problem, right? And I'm going to, like, everyone's going to jump down my throat now. I'm going to be an outcast in the chef world. I'm like, I like foie gras fine, but I could really live without it. I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, most of my friends, take away their foie gras is like taking the guns away from an NRA member. Like, they freak out. You know what I mean? But I don't think it's reasonable for me to decide like what I think is right or wrong just based on whether or not I really personally care about it that much. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I do like a hot foie gras. You know, like nice. I like it. I like it fine. It's not my favorite freaking thing on earth. What about you, Stas?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And thanks for taking the bullet with me. I like that. See, Stas, you know, Stas, for all the crap we give Stas, she is loyal, right?
It is true.
Yeah, anyway.
Did you try the foie gras donut last night?
I didn't. No, I didn't. Was it good?
I don't know. Someone said it was, they thought it was going to be like a cream, like foie gras and cream inside, but it was just straight foie gras.
Really?
Stuffed.
Really?
Was it good?
They did not like it.
Yeah, it didn't sound good.
I did not try it. I do not know. Anyway, I heard someone else who tried it. They said that they liked it, though, and their foie gras was more like a mousse on the inside. Anyway, we're not here to talk about it. Well, anyway, foie gras. So, I really don't know where I stand on this. You know, I believe that we should, you know, I eat meat, obviously. I think we should move towards humane methods of production in all forms of farming, you know, to the greatest extent possible. The question is, I think there's two things, right? There's one is that, you know, I don't like anyone being forbidden to do something or serve something that they want to serve in their restaurant. But there needs to be a limit. I mean, obviously, you're not allowed to, like, you know, murder people and serve them in restaurants, right? So there's obviously a limit on what chefs should be allowed to do in a restaurant. You know, and then, but there's the question of whether or not foie gras is basically just the poster child for what's perceived as cruelty. Because, you know, for those, if there's anyone out there who doesn't know how foie gras is produced, basically, animals eat. You force feed animals a whole boatload of stuff. Their livers inflate and become delicious. And it's called gavage. And that's really what people are griping about is gavage. You know, there's arguments to come in on a bunch of different sides, because then you have people coming in saying, well, you're shafting my cultural heritage. In fact, you know, gavage is not a recent thing. Like, the ancient Romans practiced gavage on various different animals to kind of fatten them up and increase their liver. So it's a very old practice, which doesn't make it right. You know, people enjoy the product, which doesn't make it right. The real question is this practice bad or not? I really haven't done the research on it to find out whether or not I actually think it is torture or cruelty. I'm sure that there are places where it's done in a completely horrible, inhumane manner. But the question is that necessarily the case? And from people I've spoken to, albeit unbiased people, albeit biased people, there are ways to produce foie gras where it is not a torture for the animals. And then, you know, there's the possibly, but, you know, what do I know about it? You know, apocryphal stories of, you know, in certain places, well-treated geese and ducks actually coming up to the person who's going to perform the gavage. So, in other words, they're not afraid of it. Then there's the problem of, like, yeah, you're taking care of, like, you know, this one really high-priced product. But on the other hand, you know, you're allowing the horrible farming practices to take place. You don't even call it farming, like horrible factory meat processes to take place, and not really bothering with those people, because you're targeting someone that you can easily target, because you are making people feel guilty for going out and spending a lot of money on a product that you're then associating with torture, the same way it worked on fur, right? Mm-hmm. you know, so again, I don't really know where I stand. I know Dave Chang trusts his foie gras producers. I think we get from Hudson Valley at Momofuku, and you know, and has visited their farm, has seen how they treat the animals. And for all the crap that Dave gets for being like all pro meat, like he is also pro responsible farming, and so. You know, I know he vouches for that, or at least he told – I think he said he vouches for that. Thomas Keller signed on saying, you know, he vouches for some of the producers out that he deals with as being humane. So I think if we can do it in a humane fashion, then – I don't think it's necessarily inhumane just because their livers are diseased, unquote. That doesn't make sense, right? Does that make sense to you, Nastasha? Anyway.
My mom overfeeds my cat. Can we eat the cat's liver? My mom overfeeds my cat.
Just in case you missed that, Nastasha just advocated eating pet cats. Just saying.
That's what I heard too.
Yeah, just that's just what I'm saying. Anyway, okay, okay. I gotta rip through some. Jack, do I have a little bit of time or no?
Oh yeah, you got like five more.
Okay, so let me rip through some. Let me rip through some questions. Greg writes in with a few questions. One, when you do low temperature cooking, low temp sausage, low temperature oil, which we're going to do for the Museum of Food and Drink, we're going to do beer brats or something similar at low temperatures. Come eat them. Do you pierce the casings to let the oils into the casing, or is this unnecessary? Do not do that. You want to keep the oils that were in the thing to begin with. Water-based things like beer will actually go through the membrane of the casing and, like, you know, suck flavors out and put flavors in. But you're trying to get as little flavor leach in or out as possible when you're using oil in like a Ziploc bag, so don't pierce it, and then you're just going to lose juices. Like, you know, when you take a properly cooked sausage and you poke it, it like juice sprays out of it, and that's what you kind of want. You want to keep that stuff in there. So no. Two, I've been playing around with sous vide chicken breasts recently and really love how they come out. I've been following Jason Lodgen's recommendations at 56 Celsius for 2.5 to 3 hours. That's low for me. Of course, the chicken looks anemic right out of the bag, so I've been trying to come up with a way to make fried chicken using a cheapo deep fryer. Alternatively, I could use a very hot pot of high smoke point oil, most likely peanut. Can you give me some recommendations about batters or coatings that would help here? I think that's too low. You know, you're going to fry it, you're going to bring the stuff up. Anyway, oh, I'm looking for something that would adhere nicely but be a decent vehicle for herbs and spices and would fry up quickly without significant heat soak into the meat. Listen, what you want to do is make sure you pull the stuff out when you're cooking it. Let it hot. Let it flash off for a second to get get a little bit of a pellicle on the outside. Then straight flour, right? You could salt it, but straight flour, and then put all of the flavor into like a liquid. I use buttermilk, egg, and I use basically buttermilk, egg, baking soda, baking powder, and you can put all the flavor you want in there, and then back into flour and fry. That's what I do, and I got yelled at, by some Southern guys at the last thing because they use an entirely different technique. But that, using low temperature cooking, adheres like a bastard, and you can get flavors into it. So that's what I do, and that's what I would recommend. Also, I'm the habanero pepper taming guy from way back. Other than Steingarten, Jeffrey Steingarten, our good buddy, haven't spoken to him in a while though, right? No. Anyway, it's good to labor over peppers techniques. I haven't found a decent way to reduce capsaicin load in habanero peppers, which are extremely hot. Not as hot as nagajaloki or whatever they're pronounced, ghost peppers, but they taste a whole hell of a lot better. Anyway, I still have a few more experiments to try, but recently I got access to a centrifuge, and this technique struck me. Could you emulsify the trimmed pepper flesh with some oleophilic, that means fat-loving, medium, centrifuge the whole mess and extract the supposedly capsaicin-minimized goodness from the bottom. My thought is the capsaicin is an oleomer, so if I can get it to stick to something, can I filter or separate? I guess I didn't mean fat. Anyway, I should be in good shape. Any thoughts on the process? What about oleophiles? As a first cut, I was thinking about just using olive oil, but there's also casein or other things out there that might work. Thanks. Take care. Greg. I don't think that's going to work, Greg, because you might be able to – I mean, there's no doubt you could probably get a capsaicin-enriched section of it, right? But you're not going to get all – you're not going to get all of it out, or even probably enough to make a huge dent. I did some preliminary research last week when this question came in. I didn't find anything. I'm going to keep looking to see whether there's anyone that's done any research on centrifugally separated capsaicin at lower speeds. But I'm not holding out high hopes. But I'll look into it. Right?
Yes.
Stash, you writing that down? You writing an email? No, you're not. See, I could tell because you can hear the clacks. If I ask her to write an email, and you hear the clackety clack, then you know she's doing it.
Not an email about this.
All right. What's
those
that?
Those are some cats that called in.
Wow. That's hardcore. That's hardcore. Man, we're not gonna get to all the questions today.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, listen, it's because we had a week without the show. Okay, so let me do this and then hopefully I can get one more. But Michael Nacken wrote in, longtime listener, our buddy, right? Herbivoracious, and comment on last 2 weeks ago on the show. So he said, so I couldn't possibly listen to the discussion of the vegan menu at Del Posto without writing in. The idea that this is talking about what, you know, Mark and those guys said about cooking the vegan menus. The idea that vegetarians mostly don't really love food and are just difficult diners who mainly want some sort of health food sustenance is, how can I say this for the radio, complete and utter crap. I've been a lacto-ovo vegetarian for 23 years, and I pretty much never think about anything besides food and how to maximize the pleasure of my next meal. But I'm fully engaged with food. I listen to your show. I've read Modernist Cuisine from cover to cover and have stashed at a few restaurants. My first book, cookbook is coming out this week, and it's called Herbivoracious, A Flavor Revolution with 150 Vibrant and Original Vegetarian Recipes. In fact, publication date is today. I looked it up on Amazon. Should be interesting. Congratulations and good luck with the book. Anyway, I think if you take a look at it, you'll agree that there's no aspect of self-sacrifice involved. For me, being a vegetarian is just a completely personal thing. I'm not wired to want to eat animals, and I don't think I'm alone. There are many of us who don't eat animals but love food. I'd love to see more high-end restaurants take that seriously, not simply throw some pasta in a beurre blanc our way and hope we don't care. Thanks, Michael. Now, first of all, in defense of Del Posto, clearly that's not what they were doing, right? You know what I mean? Also, I think, here's the thing, right? This is a tough problem. I mean, like, obviously, Michael, you love food, and there's whole cultures, whole civilizations that are based on, especially lacto-ovo vegetarianism. I think the chef's gripe is probably more against vegans, I would say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No,
I mean, I don't know.
But even so, like, there's no such thing
it's
as
the
like
personalities.
Well, this is the thing. You're just it's like racism, basically.
Yes,
you're basically a racist.
I have something to say.
Okay.
Last night we were coming back from dinner.
Who's we?
After Mark and I were coming back from dinner, just a small dinner of like miso soup, a salad, and fried chicken. And we have leftover fried chicken. And we're walking on like 58th and 9th or something.
This sounds like a classic nostalgia story right here. Okay.
And there's a homeless person on cardboard wrapped in like a very nasty blanket. This poor guy, right? And he's asking everyone who passes for change. And I say, I have some food in this bag. And he said, what is it? And I said, it's fried chicken. And he said, I don't eat chicken because it depends on where it's been raised.
Okay. See, you have no respect for human dignity. Nastasha has no respect for human dignity.
I'm saying, look at how, you know, lots of people are very discerning. It doesn't matter.
What? It's not discerning. The guy has a moral. Because the guy doesn't have a home, he can't have morals on whether or not he eats chicken?
But, yes. No, I'm saying good for him.
So, are you saying good
I'm
for
saying
him?
I'm saying good for him, yeah.
Good for him.
Good for him.
All right, so you're not.
I know, I'm not.
You're not saying anything bad about this guy.
No, not at all.
All right. Well, I misjudged you then.
Thank you.
All right. The point is that the issue is that a lot of chefs. Here's the deal: chefs don't like pick what they perceive as pickiness in any form, mm-hmm. right? And so the issue is if they perceive what's going on as just being pickiness, it's not that they don't mind the work. Chefs love work and they love problems. You know what I mean? They like a challenge. They like this. They don't like picky people in general, as a generalization. And what they do is that people, they don't necessarily, and here's the real crux, respect the decisions other people make based on their diet. Right? Say it's accurate, Nastasha?
Mm-hmm.
And so they perceive that as being, they perceive certain dietary choices, not in 100% of the cases, but they perceive the people who make them as making decisions that are either A, picky, B, whiny, or C, antisocial in some cases.
Right.
Right?
Well, I think they spent a lot of time, they work with food. They make choices, they make recipes based on their love of food. And when there's a picky eater, and it creates a whole new...
But Michael's clearly not a picky eater. That's what I'm saying. But here's the problem is when it comes to generalization. You know what I mean? So, I mean, and it's disingenuous to basically give, you know, Michael a pass because he's a lacto-ovo vegetarian. I guarantee you there's vegans out there who love food. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's a lot harder, I think. You know, anytime you limit your palate, it's more of a challenge. It becomes more difficult, and then it becomes harder for people who don't cook that way to produce a product on the quality level that they want to produce. See, in other words, another problem that chefs have is that they want to produce the best quality stuff that they can produce for you. And if they don't sit around all day thinking about the best way to make a vegan meal, then it's hard for them to produce their what they think is their best showing, right?
That's true.
When they're doing vegan. If you add on to that sorry to say it, but this is like innate, right? Like an innate distrust of any sort of thing that they see as picky, then you're like, you know, you're adding insult to injury. But I think, I don't know how the hell this is coming off the outside world.
Probably
here.
Probably
horribly. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, you're right. I mean, we should judge a chef should judge every customer they come in on their own merits. And there's plenty of meat eaters who are some picky some bitches who, you know, who chefs don't like dealing with. I don't like salt. I don't like, you know what I mean? There are people who legitimately can't have too much salt because they're hypertensive. But then there are people who say that they don't like it. It's like, okay, like I'm allergic to stuff. I'll die if I eat like a large quantity of raw cherries. And the only reason I'm allergic to it is because I'm being punished for making fun of people's allergies for years. Do you know what I'm saying? But chefs do that all the time.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But I think, you know, part of the, if you go to the Amazon and you look at Michael's cookbook, Michael Nackin's new cookbook, and you read the copy for it, which I did today, basically he's saying, you know, this is food that you'll be happy to cook for your meat-eating friends because it's basically just delicious. I love that. I support that. And it's very similar, actually. Pat Brown, who's a professor at Stanford, he's a vegetarian, is working to try and make meat analogs. And he's doing it actually because he does want to proselytize. He wants people to stop eating meat. He wants meat to stop being produced. He wants people to stop farming meat. He's friends with Harold McGee. We spoke to him. Anyways, so his point is you will never decrease the amount of meat that is consumed in this country by the average person unless you make a product that a meat eater wants to eat more than the meat they're eating now. And that's it. Right?
Yeah.
All right. Listen, I got a couple questions I didn't get to. We'll get you next week. Cooking issues.